This is Penn Sunday School, and to our listening ears, all angels sing and round us sweet the music of the sweet.
And here we go.
Brothers, sisters, siblings, welcome to Penn Sunday School, brought to you by Masterclass. I'm Matt Donnelly, and we're broadcasting from various places around the United States. With us today, a very special guest, Jane Borden, author of Cults Like Us, a cult writer in general, now with an awesome book, here to talk to Penn and us about our possible cult. Here's Penn Jillette.
Wow, was that shitty?
Yeah.
A terrible job at that. Yeah, really yeah. Awful. Anyway, this is
my Penn, brain said I'll get a bit, and then it didn't come.
You just all you wanted to do was just do the thing, are we a cult thing at the end.
Yeah. And I didn't start
it. You didn't
right.
set it up.
Not at all.
You were totally
I was late. I basically was, yeah. I missed the oh yeah, and they're all nuns moment in the joke. I was
you did.
Past that.
Yeah.
And
Anyway, we're brought to you by Masterclass.
Yeah.
And we're hoping Matt Donnelly takes a Masterclass in structuring. I don't think you really need joke structure. I think we should start with sentence structure. And you can get 50% off right now on lifelong learning at masterclass.com/Penn. Jane.
Hi.
This is the kind of book I would read even if Matt Donnelly didn't know you.
Oh, that's a compliment. Two parts of that.
I read books like this once in a while, and I usually have one of them going, and it's a subject I'm very interested in. I like this book even more than the others I read. One, because you do something in this book that, unless it's done perfectly, I dislike it. Which is you are funny in the book. And usually when people are doing kind of very serious subjects and they do too many jokes, I dislike them very, very much. It always seems like, it's like the Neil deGrasse Tyson thing, you know, where he's a really good science writer and a really shitty stand-up comedian. And he forces those together and just makes it so I don't even like him that much as a science writer anymore. But you managed to have all your jokes on topic, and they're always illuminating, which is a very, very difficult thing to do. You don't ever seem to do something in service of the joke. You seem to do it in service of the idea, which is... so commendable and makes the reading so memorable and great.
Oh, thanks.
So man. Thanks for writing a wonderful book.
And that's all the time we have. Thank you so much.
Yeah. I also like your book because it does something that I don't enjoy, but I feel is good for me. And that is, it's a very threatening book for me.
Hmm.
Because I really feel that this is fading away since the pandemic, but I used to really feel I was a rugged individual, and Kerouac and Ginsberg mm-hmm. and all the beat poets were all fighting against a square kind of world. And I've been realizing more and more that that's just part of the hype, mm-hmm. part of our culture. And that you can't get away from it. It's part of the thing of trying to pretend the Beatles were counterculture when they were the most popular band in the world, and trying to pretend that Howard Stern was some sort of outsider when he was the most popular broadcaster, and absolutely saying what every single person in his audience believed. Not an outsider in any way, shape, or form. And your point about the cliches in our detective shows and our comic book shows being really important, and not just being lazy writing, but also being a deeply kind of lazy thinking, was great, and makes me feel less good about myself, which is something I always want out of a book.
Did you get that when you read the Bible too?
When I read the Bible, I feel much better about myself. at least I'm not smoting people at random for all my sins.
Well, thank you for those kind words. I am trying to get people to look at things we've seen 100 times in a different way. I want us to recognize and acknowledge the ways that the doomsday thinking of our founding cult, the Puritans, are still with us. The acknowledgement, the recognition, I think, is the first step in my grand plan of taking over the world. No. I started doing this work because I was shaken up by the division in our nation. How can people who are really basically the same see themselves as polar opposites? And cults are fueled by division. And I started to see cult-like thinking, which I'd been reporting on at the time for Vanity Fair, everywhere in American culture and politics and entertainment. And I just started pulling the thread. And then one day I realized, oh, the Puritans were kind of a cult. If people looked at them today, they would say, that's a cult, the Pilgrims and the Puritans. And if we want to get into technicalities, I technically call them a high-control doomsday group. But, they were very radical, and their doomsday ideology didn't go away. It just became the foundation of secular American culture.
Yeah, that switch from religious to secular is so important in your book and not really intuitive. I would not, having been a outspoken atheist for a very long time, I don't consider myself particularly susceptible to that. And yet libertarianism sucked me in completely, based on me thinking that the cult of the individual, not so much with a strong leader, which I think you need for, that's one of your 3 points.
Mm-hmm. For quote unquote cult, yeah.
Yeah, but I was a little more interested in how that, did you read, very likely you did, Kurt Anderson's book, Fantasyland?
That's a great book.
You complement each other so well in that, because his idea that Americans were selected for belief in fantasy, and your idea that founded on a cult is so interesting. I was fascinated, because I had never read this anywhere else, on the stuff you wrote about Columbus. We have had, in our lifetimes, found another 3 or 4 ways to shit on Columbus. But you found yet another one.
Yeah.
So tell us about Columbus.
He was not greedy. The reason he came here for all that gold and spices and mastic, etc., was not avarice. He was trying to bring back Jesus. He thought God had ordained him to trigger the second coming. And he had a specific checklist that he was working through of things he needed to do before Jesus would come back, which, first of all, I mean, just the idea that, like, Jesus and God are waiting around for us to make it okay for Jesus to come back is, like
Jesus,
arrogant.
Jesus pokes us through the clouds like, has he gotten the gold from America yet? No? All right. I'll go back to making this omelet then.
Back to playing Nintendo. Some of the items on his checklist were quite expensive endeavors. So expel all the Muslims from the Holy Land. That's a war. That's a crusade of sorts, and he was raising money for
some of them. Not bad ideas.
Rediscovering Eden. I mean, that sounds great.
Sure.
Yeah. But so that's what he was after, and there's historical record. You know, letters he wrote to Isabella and Ferdinand explaining that he's raising money for the cavalry needed for the conquest. You know.
Now, did he consider himself the leader of this movement, or? Where did he get his checklist?
This guy, Joachim de Fiore, who was, I want to say, 13th century abbot. At that time, apocalyptic thinking bubbled up, and it's always been with us. Well, not always. It's been with us since the birth of monotheism. And then, of course, it exploded with the Jesus cult, and then it bubbled up again in the 1200s, and that's who came up with this checklist. And the Franciscan order was very much influenced by this checklist, and Columbus got mixed up with the Franciscans, and that's how he got his hands on it. And he thought, you know, people who apocalyptic thinkers tend to have main character syndrome, and that's why he thought that he was, he did see himself as central, yes, as chosen by God specifically to carry Christ across the waters. That's what he thought his name meant, Christopher.
How was he made aware of the fact that he was chosen?
Good question. I would argue that almost always people just kind of have a feeling, or maybe they think they hear a voice. You know, it's usually not someone else telling them. It's a self-appointing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the people that I know that knew Prince very well said that there was no doubt that God talked to Prince. They do not believe that that was hype or lying at all. They believe that God talked to Prince and that there was no doubt about that.
Is that something Prince said?
Prince said that God had told him to change his name to the symbol.
Oh, right, right.
And many of us just thought, well, that's a good marketing thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I was surprised that, that probably not a marketing thing. And I'm also a big fan of Sun Ra, who is from Saturn. And I'm starting to believe he was from Saturn. That is to say that he believed it and and did not, was not a showbiz thing. It gets very confusing when people are showbiz people who do this. So I kind of wondered if Columbus was actually having a dialogue with God or just a feeling, or I guess that's been lost in the sands of time.
If it remains, I didn't come across it. Interestingly, there were a few pages in his, I was about to say diaries, but it wasn't. He wrote a book, and a few pages were stolen at one point. So there's a little bit of mystery about who didn't want what to get out about Columbus.
It wasn't just about banging Isabella.
It was his fanfic.
I think it's funny because, like, if you accidentally bankroll a zealot instead of a greedy person, you're like, oops.
Yeah.
But that is oops.
Right. But you're like, oh, if you just want to go and pillage and just take shit for our country, great. But if you thought he could find the Garden of Eden, I kind of want to get my name out of that book.
Yeah, probably.
It's the weird.
Yeah, but it's such a... it seems like traveling across the ocean or around the world is so unpleasant.
Oh yeah.
You'd have to be driven in some sort of insane way. You know?
Yeah.
It's not like a good natured guy is going to get in a ship and maybe sail off the end of the world.
I really like the low level skeptic on the ship. Who's like, I don't think we're going to find it. I don't want to say anything, but I don't think it's out there. The Garden of Eden, I don't think it's going to happen.
I mean, God was talking to me, and he was like, I think you turned the wrong way at the sunset.
just like...
y'all could just get a really good watch. This would be a lot better. You could tell where the fuck we are. Yeah, you know, when I read a book, I read it on Kindle, and I pull quotations from the book all the time, which I go back to. And as I said, I'm not all the way through your book, but boy, am I pulling a lot. There's just so many observations that seem really important. Talk a little bit about the anti-intellectualism and the anti-urban and the anti-elites thing.
Mm-hmm.
That is... We are now really deeply into that, but it's always been there. Can you kind of talk of the history of that? The anti-intellectualism is so disturbing.
It's very American, and it was very Puritan. So the Puritans didn't invent anti-intellectualism. It was somewhat popular in the Renaissance, the idea that the fool character was often lionized, the idea being that if you were simple-minded, at least you weren't deceitful. And the Puritans took this and ran with it.
Because they never met Gary Busey.
That's right. The John Winthrop's City Upon a Hill speech, there was evidence of how much they wish they had met Gary Busey.
Because they could see, they could find simple and devious real easy right there.
Yeah, that's why they came to America. They were looking for Busey. Yeah. So they, a little bit, it was reactionary. So they valued simplicity of dress, of manners, of language. And this has been called, reactionary because they were being persecuted by England, by power structures that people were mannered and intelligent and wore fancy clothes. And the Puritans were kind of thumbing their noses at that and saying, we don't need any of that. Look at us. We're different and we're better, and actually God hates you. And the Satan figure became conflated with the princely gentleman who's intelligent and uses his wiles, and the Antichrist figure as well. And so there was a quote, the more witty you be, the more fit to act for Satan will you be. And so there was anti-intellectuals. I mean, I should also say, the Puritans set up schools. Education was important. There were limits to this. But they were also anti-elitist. And so there was always the fear that European manners were encroaching on America, and we have to keep them out. And Benjamin Franklin talked about this, the idea that the coastal merchant cities, which is still happening today, right? The coastal elites were the worst thing about America, and the good simple folk further inland, gosh, if we can just keep them from being corrupted by the coastal mannered elite, AKA Europe. There was another quote, coming up with a funny way to distinguish between heaven and hell. It was, are you going to go to heaven or go to Europe?
I was very surprised at Ben Franklin. I call him Ben because we're friends. having that feeling. I never felt like Benjamin Franklin would have been would have that kind of anti-intellectualism, anti-European thing. I mean,
And this is all wrapped up in the rebellion idea of Americans, the idea that we're rebellious by nature, which I think we are. And that's also the nature of Protestantism. Protestantism itself was a rebellion. And it,
right in the title.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just continues to fracture. And there's always some new upstart saying, no, you guys are wrong and you're going to hell. We're the only one true way. And, again and again. I mean, there's one organization, I'm blanking on the name of the church, but at one point the leader died and the son took over, and then suddenly within 30 years there were like 200 sub-factions of this one church. So it's very much baked into Protestantism, which is baked into American culture. We're a nation of individuals who like to rebel against any kind of power.
Now, would you talk a little bit about how much of this is human and how much of this is American? Mm-hmm. I mean, where do we see it other places, and where do we not see it? I mean, China certainly. But why don't you talk about it? Because you know.
cult-like thinking is human. It's a human quality, and we evolved in many ways to be attracted to us versus them thinking. For example, the desire for order in a chaotic world. These are human tendencies. Even conspiracist thinking, that's something that we evolved. It's kind of an evolutionary hangover that we see threats where they don't exist, because people who are good at seeing threats passed on their genes, right? So I like to say that conspiracy theorists aren't stupid. They're just maybe a little too smart.
But that's why we hate them.
Well, even talking about like mainstream figures or whatever, like every movie, there's so many movies where like you're the only person who knows the truth and the government's trying to keep you from getting that word out to everybody else. And if they just found out, then everything would change. Like that's in so many movies and mainstream television shows.
Mm-hmm. You'd almost say every one of them.
Right.
You know, Jack Bauer in 24 doesn't even have a job for the last five seasons. He's quit his job in season one and continues on his own.
Yeah.
He's no longer working for an anti-terrorist agency. He's just out there.
Driven by a quest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But do you get this kind of Protestant thinking in China, in Africa, in...
I believe that cult-like thinking and participation in cults are both more prevalent in America than elsewhere, despite our evolutionary commonality toward it, because for two reasons. I believe we are latently indoctrinated into the doomsday ideas of our radical Protestant cult-like founders, and also because of freedom of religion. So it's baked into the Constitution that you can believe whatever you want, no matter how wackadoodle it might seem to other people. And so for upstart business people, let's be honest, who are looking to make money off of people by convincing them of a certain belief system and getting them to follow them, it's quite easy to do that. And the government's not going to do anything about it. And if they can gain church status, then we don't even ask them to pay taxes. So if you are a con artist looking for this kind of money, a business opportunity, America is the place to do it. And following the Great Awakenings that just flattened church hierarchy, which at this point is completely atomized, everyone is a charismatic leader. Everyone can start their own movement. I mean, on social media, we literally call them influencers. And I think it's very much the American nature to look for someone to follow that's not mainstream, to look for fringe ideas, because again, we're anti-establishment, and a lot of these groups are as well.
Now, do you see, do you make the distinction between cult and a religion? Let's throw out Buddhism because it's too hard to talk about in this, but do you see Catholicism as a cult?
The definition that's agreed upon today by the anti-cult movement comes from a psychologist named Robert Lifton, and it has three characteristics. There's a leader who's worshipped. The worship part is very important. There's undue influence, coercive control, what we used to call brainwashing. And there's actual harm done, typically to those within the group, typically financial and sexual. So the word cult used to be a lot more vague. And so you could toss it around at a variety of organizations. I'm sure the Catholic Church has been called a cult at one point or another. I mean, the Puritans believe the Pope was the Antichrist.
But doesn't the Catholic Church hit all three of those pretty directly?
Well, the leader being worshipped, I guess you're talking about the Pope.
Always I'm talking about the Pope.
Get Penn to shut up about the Pope.
He's good. He said dogs go to heaven. I thought he was a totally good guy.
He seems like a, I don't know, I'm not a Pope expert. It's questionable, because ultimately they worship someone above the Pope. It just happens to be that that person isn't currently around. So it would be hard to say that the Pope is worshipped as the one and true leader. I don't know. It's tricky. You know, I interviewed a religious studies scholar who was very reluctant to call anything a cult. He doesn't like the word. And one of his arguments was, well, if you want to talk about sexual exploitation, there's no group that's done more of it than the Catholic Church. Right. And if we're talking about financial exploitation, there's no groups that's done more of it probably than mega churches. So where do you draw the line? What's the distinction? And it is sticky. It's definitely sticky. I think an organization like the Catholic Church has a power structure with a little bit more checks and balances than, say, you know, David Koresh had. Mm-hmm. But yes, it's murky, no doubt.
But at least it's a filter to take a look at stuff, because it immediately does bring these kind of terrible flaws to mind. I mean, you know, the financial mm-hmm. and the sexual abuse of these organizations, at least it helps you think about it. At least it helps you go like, I don't like that aspect of it, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you know, I don't find any of the religious stuff very personally threatening, because having been an atheist for so long. But how do you tie in punk rock, you know, how those kinds of movements, which I think are just silly, I mean, until they're not, you know. Mm. Punk rock, which was really just a rebellion against, you know, Steely Dan and the Eagles, ended up being much more than that. And, you know, we think of it often as being English, but it really does start in the U.S. with the Velvet Underground and Jonathan Richman and then the Ramones. And then I also think at the same time, you also have country music, where it seems like so much of country music is, I'm a loner, I'm a cowboy, and stay away from the cities and stay away from the coastal elites. How do you see that secular cultural stuff is feeding into it? How much of, I mean, many of the followers of Donald Trump, when I was first incredulous that anybody was following him, friends of mine said, go to a heavy metal concert.
Hmm.
They're all Trump followers. It's all MAGA. And certainly country music seems to tie into that as well. Do you see that as part of the American cultural scene that leads to this, or am I just overextending it?
I mean, the country music culture in the ways you've described it makes me think about the American monomyth, which you referenced at the beginning of our conversation, which looks at the classic American narrative that we see. I mean, there were three movies out last month that follow this narrative. It's everywhere. But the basic structure of the story is there's a small Edenic-like community that's threatened by something, and they're unable to save themselves. The politicians are corrupt. The police force is inept. What are they going to do? And then suddenly this outsider arrives. And even if the the Redeemer is from within the community, they're usually a loner within the community. And they save the day through violence. It's always violence, and it's surgical violence with surgical precision. Only the bad guys get it. And therefore, it's cleansing violence. Therefore, it's righteous violence. And this narrative is every Western. It's every comic book. It's every superhero movie now. It's vigilante narratives. It's even in Jaws. I mean, it's everywhere. And I found this research into the American monomyth by a couple of scholars who developed it in the 70s. During the Vietnam War, they were trying to figure out how could America be stomaching this incredible violence that we were seeing in our living rooms for the first time. I would please everyone buy my book first, but then also get the American Monomyth. It's so eye-opening. And then you just can't stop seeing the doomsday narrative, because that's ultimately what it is it's from the Book of Revelation. And they trace it also to Indian captivity narratives, which were written around the Puritan settlement, where when people were rescued from their kidnapping by indigenous peoples, the wilderness was then cleansed. But it ultimately traces to the Book of Revelation, with which the Puritans were obsessed, this story of divine retribution. We want to be, not only do we want to be saved, we want to see our enemies get it. And often in the retelling of the Book of Revelation and popular retellings, the chosen people are pulled up first, and they get to help. And they get to watch, even when it's their family members who are being doomed. Like, that's the reward for being chosen, is to like watch you throw my son into the lake of fire. At any rate,
name those three movies.
Oh, from last month. Let's see. The Amateur, the Rami Malek vigilante flick. The Accountant 2, Ben Affleck, unlikely violent redeemer. And then there was one, oh God, The Working Man,
Jason
Man's
Stratham.
Work. Yes.
Yeah. Jason Stratham, Working Man, yeah.
Yeah, there are probably more. Those are just the ones I happen to notice on billboards.
Oh, it's action movies. I mean, it's every action movie, right? Like every...
It's most, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's very American, you know, and when people ask, why are we obsessed with violence? I think it's the Book of Revelation. I mean, it's ecstatically violent. And first of all, it should never have been canonized. Even at the time when the Bible was being canonized, a lot of people were like, no, this is insanity. But it got through in part because they thought it was written by John the Baptist. It was a different John altogether. Mm. Oops. But there's one point, there's one point in the Book of Revelation where an angel collects all of the wicked on the earth. This is the Grapes of Wrath story. Collects all the wicked on the earth, puts them in a giant wine press, crushes them, and so much blood comes out that a river of blood flows as high as a horse's bridle for 200 miles. Ooh. And this is what people want. They want this to happen. They want doomsday. We want to see it. We want to be chosen, but we want to see our enemies punished.
It was really remarkable when Donald Trump actually stated that when he got back into office, he would be punishing people.
Mm-hmm. Day one, and he did. immediately he did what I mean, it's I did a compare and contrast between the Book of Revelation and Trump's first weeks for Vanity Fair, because it's the parallels are unnerving. Everyone who worked on January 6th trials is fired or demoted, and everyone who was arrested for January 6th is freed.
Yeah.
Right out of the gate.
And I think I'm not in any way special. Yeah, let me get out of the bottom of it for a moment. I would have considered that completely impossible just 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
No, but I think like we took pride, like American pride in having, you know, not, I don't think anyone took huge pride in checks and balances, but I think we took pride that our country was big, right? And so to do things that a dictator would do in a smaller country was considered laughable, right? And mm-hmm. then all of a sudden it seems like people were very cool with the idea of a dictator.
Well, that's what we want. And I think that this is the result of our latent indoctrination into the doomsday beliefs of our Puritan founders. We want an autocrat. The nation is flirting with autocracy now. Maybe we're beyond the flirting stage. And Trump showed up at just the right time. I don't think there's anything special about him. I don't think there's anything special about any cult leader. I think people...
Oh, come on, Charlie Manson.
Very special.
We like to think, God, people are obsessed with Charles Manson. The amount of women who like threw themselves at him, just
this is why,
fascinating.
This is really my subtext in talking to you. I have made it very clear that now that I'm 70 years old, I want to start a cult. because it seems like, who is the guy who did the health food store in L.A.?
The source.
The guy who started the Source, you know, he was like my age, dressing in white, surrounded by young women, and then he jumps off a mountain in Hawaii thinking he can hand glide when he can't. That's certainly the story I want for myself.
That's how you want to go out.
No, sure, yeah. But, the obsession with Charlie Manson is fascinating. And I look at it from a distance and then instantly get sucked in. Mm-hmm. When anyone's talking about it, I find myself interested in spite of myself. I can't explain it.
I'm fascinated by that attraction we have to these groups. I mean, there's a new cult documentary on a streamer every day right now. I think we want to watch because we want to understand how it works so that we don't fall for it. I think we also want to watch because a little bit we want to fall for it. We're attracted. And that goes back to our evolutionary design as well, is that being a part of a tribe, for lack of a better word, is very attractive to us, particularly during times of crisis. So that's why I said now was the right time for Donald Trump, because cult-like thinking increases at the societal level during times of crisis and social upheaval, which we're seeing, and technological revolution, which we're seeing. And I think the biggest, the most pressing crisis, at least, facing Americans right now is that no one has any money anymore. We're chronically under-resourced because the billionaires have been taking all the money since the Reagan administration, methodically. And we've let it happen.
Also, Kurt Anderson.
Okay. He writes about that as well.
He documents it very well, yeah.
Yeah. And we've let that happen because we worship the wealthy in our nation. We equate the number in someone's bank account with their moral character, which also comes from the Puritans. It's a very cult-like idea. And so if the rich get their money from God, which is what John D. Rockefeller used to say, he got his money from God, then the poor must be sinners. It must be that God looked at them and said, nope, you're not worthy. And so then why would we help the poor when sin should be punished? And of course, we see that over and over again with welfare reform, exploitation that's happening of the poor with new financial, inventive financial products, quote unquote, such as overdraft fees. MLMs are taking advantage of, it's always people who are already running out of money. It's people who've lost their jobs. It's new immigrants. That's who MLMs go after. And then they, the poor, and then they just mine them like a resource. And I think rich Americans have started to see the poor as a resource to be mined, and they're a renewable resource, so you can keep making money.
You know, we did a show on Showtime called Bullshit, and we did a multi-level marketing one, and they wouldn't let us use the word pyramid, so we did it in front of pyramids all around us. Of all the subjects we did some very upsetting subjects. It was the one that crushed my heart the most.
Yeah.
Because the people in the multi-level marketing that we interviewed were so, to my heart, undeniably good. And what they were trying to do was using all the things that I hold in very high regard. They wanted to work hard. Mm-hmm. They wanted to plan. They wanted to do all of these things, and it was all being used against them. Mm-hmm. The better angels of their nature being turned against them to destroy them and make someone else rich. So upsetting. And I am completely sucked in to the individual, individual accomplishments, making people rich. I mean, I knew Steve Jobs, I know Bill Gates, I know Bezos, and I've always felt with this huge amount of luck coupled with it, that they were also using techniques that I find ethical to accomplish pretty wonderful things. And your tying that in with the Puritans, I find wonderfully troubling, because it's so easy to read stuff about how other people are fucked up, but I really get interested when it's about how I'm fucked up. Hmm. And I am a complete part of that culture and completely buy into it. And it wasn't until the plague, COVID, that I started to see libertarianism in a whole different way, which I don't think you can, it doesn't have all the definitions of cult, but does have the monomyth thing, which which those two things are so closely related, but yet different.
Well, I was just going to say that the fact that you acknowledge that luck plays a role in the success of the people you named, suggests that you maybe shouldn't be too hard on yourself because what these people who are looking to exploit negate the role of luck. They don't want their riches to have come from anyone but God. They don't want to acknowledge that that luck played a role, because that means they didn't do it all themselves. That means their success isn't just a result of their moral character. And I had a fascinating interview with this scholar named Angus Fletcher, who studied the something called the lucky twist in narrative storytelling in history. And he basically argues that for all of written history and probably oral history, stories, there were lucky twists of fate that happened to good people and bad people. Didn't matter who you were as a person. Sometimes you came out on top and sometimes you didn't. And that basically got destroyed by the Enlightenment and the Reformation. Suddenly everything had to be more black and white. Good things only happen to good people. Bad things only happen to bad people. And then Charles Perrault went and rewrote all of the fairy tales into the ones that we have today. And the problem with that is that the reason this lucky twist had such staying power historically is that it helps you develop optimism. Hey, something bad happened to me today, but something good could happen to me tomorrow. Or hey, the bad guy won today, but that won't always happen, right? Whereas now that good things only happen to good people and bad things happen to, but morality tales, now that we have morality tales, that instead develops anxiety. So kids are growing up watching these, you know, movies, mostly Disney, but not exclusively, and not all Disney movies are that way, but at any rate, thinking, oh, if something bad happens to me, I'm a bad person. And if a bad thing happened to me now, then bad things are just going to keep happening to me because that's who I am.
Wow. Wow.
Never heard that before. I've really never heard that before. That's significant.
Well, so okay. One of the things that can combat all this crazy stuff is lifelong learning. Yeah. The more you know, the better off you are. And this is definitely not a cult. Masterclass has 11 categories, over 200 instructors. The idea is lifelong learning. And once you become a member of Masterclass, you get to have all the instructors are there available for you and able to do it. And you can pick and choose, and it's on every platform. It's good while driving, it's good while exercising, and it's also good to just sit down and focus on it. You anything you want to say there, Ready Rich?
Oh, I'd like to revisit the masterclass from our friend Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure, please do.
Science and communication.
Mm-hmm.
You might be especially interested in lesson 11 with the use of humor to convey your point.
Well, you know, that is...
I like the part about the mathematical breakdown of Perepadoskin and the rule of 50, but you might have other interests.
Okay. But there's a lot to learn. Which one are you studying now, Matt?
I'm still going through the one with the Malala. I'm still going through her how to be an advocate.
When you're discovering the things you don't care about.
Yeah. I've moved on to more important lessons, but yes. Yeah.
Well, you can get 50% off with because they've been supporters of Penn Sunday School. They are their only supporter. They are the reason we're able to do this. So please check them out. All you've got to do to get your discount is go to masterclass.com/Penn. That's 50% off right now at masterclass.com/Penn. Masterclass.com/Penn. You know, Mike Nesmith, yes, of the Monkees, was a very good friend of mine. And Nez did some really interesting stuff. He would just, he was richer than God because of luck, and among other things. And he would invite people out to just talk to him, which is much rarer in our society than it should be. So he would invite Bill Gates over to talk for 5 hours all afternoon, and Steve Jobs. And what the two of us talking together found fascinating was if you talk to Bill Gates, really hard to go 10 minutes before Bill Gates mentions how lucky he was. Because Bill Gates knows off the top of his head names and phone numbers of 12 people smarter and harder working than him that are less successful. I don't mean they're poor, but they're less successful. Steve Jobs would mention luck in the first 10 minutes. I mean, all of them do. And I found it fascinating that in all the time I spent with Trump, which was significant, never heard him use the word luck in reference to himself. And that to me was a huge difference. As they say, born on third base and thinks he got there on his own.
Thinks he hit a triple. You hate sports so much, Ben, you don't even know the metaphor that you're using.
Oh, okay. what did I say? I just didn't go to football, did I?
You said he thinks he got there on his own, as if like maybe the game was happening, maybe not, but he's having to walk his way over to third base.
I have to learn not to use sports metaphors. I was talking to Teller the other day, and I used a tennis metaphor, and then we both paused for a second, and I said, neither of us ever watch or play tennis. Why would that be the clearest way for us to communicate? So forget that I said that about Trump. He was lucky and denies it. Isn't that a clearer way to say it?
Yes.
They always do when they have something to hide. That's my opinion. Because if you're convincing people I got what I got on my own, then those at the bottom think, well, I have no chance of getting anything, so why should I try? Why should I fight? You know, when you can distract people with their own supposed shame by manufacturing shame, and this is what they do in MLMs. If you're failing, oh, that's your fault. It's not because you've been unlucky. It's not because the system is designed for you to fail, because we're actually just taking money out of your pockets. It's you. Something's wrong with you. Go take a look in the mirror. And eventually these people leave, and they leave quietly because of the shame, rather than trying to blow the whole thing up. And so when you distract people with shame, then they're too busy self-loathing to try to change the system, to try to fight for any of the things that would alleviate their struggles.
I mean, I have been hit up for multi-level marketing many times in my life as someone who really keeps changing occupations every 5 or 6 years. all the seductive language, the exclusive language, like even before, we were joking about Christopher Columbus being handed a list. And then I realized that, like, I remember when I was struggling with our first kid at a playground, a mother hitting me up to be like, hey, you know, if you want to get out of the rat race, I know a guy who, well, you know, he doesn't work for money, lets his money work for him. And I can introduce you to him if you want. I can schedule a lunch, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And I come home, tell my wife, I'm like, oh, this person, I don't know what it's about, but they want me to meet for lunch, whatever. And I start describing it to my wife, and she was like, who are you going to meet?
From
a playground, you know?
It's always the women who figure out the scheme, by the way. So Amway was notorious for indoctrinating wives. They had all these special sessions to indoctrinate the wives, because the wives are often the ones being like, hey, I'm not so sure about those.
I actually was like, they insist that I bring Sarah with me to the meeting. Sarah obviously was like, you know, and you don't go either. I was like, I should go just to see what it's about or whatever. And then I came home and I was like, you're right. It's coffee. It was a stupid multi-level marketing scheme. I'm done.
That's why they wanted her to come.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
And at that coffee, they could have handed me a list of like, here's, you got to find the Garden of Eden. You need gold from South America. You need whatever. And I would have been like, I mean,
those fucking Muslims out of the hole for the love of Christ.
And I was like, I'm ambitious. I'm a real self-starter. I'm self-motivated. I've always dreamed of being an entrepreneur. I can get all the Muslims out of the Holy Land. No problem.
Oh, I would love to see you try.
No, you're seeing it right now, Jerry. You're seeing it right now. He's working right now.
Very hard.
I don't know if what I'm about to say is even incendiary anymore, because I feel like it's becoming common sense. But as I say in the book, I think the American dream is now a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
I think it used to be a real thing when it was actually available to people, but it no longer is. It's a lie. It's a carrot that's dangled to get people to work and work and work, which only makes money for their CEOs. So CEOs used to make 20 times more than their employees. Now they make like 340 yeah. times more or something like that. And so I don't see much difference between late stage American capitalism and an MLM. They look almost exactly the same to me. The statistics, so 1% in an MLM are making money and 94% are broke. And in America, it's 1% of people have the same amount of money as 90% of everyone else. It's wealth redistribution.
I do want to argue a little bit in favor of capitalism. I just had a friend say that, you know, Mao and Trump showed you that going too far in the direction of communism or too far in the direction of capitalism was wrong. I think calling Trump a capitalist is insane. He is the most anti-capitalist person we've ever had. The Art of the Deal is an anti-capitalist book. The most important part of capitalism is that when people make a deal, they both enter it voluntarily, mm-hmm. and they're both happy with it. The rule we have in Penn and Teller is we will not sign a contract unless we would sign the other side of it. Mm. Trump, every single transaction, there has to be a winner and a loser. Mm-hmm. For capitalism, every single transaction, there must be two winners. Capitalism is nonsense. I just put balloons up. I put my fingers up. Now I can do confetti. Anyway.
I'm all about Adam Smith. I thought his ideas were revolutionary and incredibly positive. That is not where we are right now.
No, not even close. But it bothers me when we use the word capitalism so incorrectly. Making a deal where one person gets ripped off is not capitalism. It is thievery.
So instead of the phrase late stage capitalism, we should just be calling it thievery?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Sure.
It's kind of like in tennis when you serve.
When you just take the balls and put them in your pocket?
Yeah, where you just say, get out of my tennis court. I own this now.
My ignorance of sports is remarkable.
Oh, same. I remember one time we had in my old improv group, we had like a team meeting because one of the women in the group was like, you guys need to stop using sports analogies in general and on stage because I don't know them and it's not fair. And I was like, okay, respect. Yeah.
Yeah. Teller and I were challenged by the crew for the two of us together to name five sports teams, what cities they were from, and what game they played. And we were able to do it, but we had to work together, and it took us a remarkably long time. And if we had only had one guess, we wouldn't have made it, because we got the wrong sports on two of them on the way.
The only sport I like to watch, that's not true. My favorite sport to watch among only a small number is high school girls lacrosse, high school girls field hockey. It's exquisite.
I'm sure I could be convinced to watch, but not for reasons that you would agree.
You go there dressed in white and with a ticket to the end of a cliff.
Yeah. Hey, girls, I got the answer.
I mean, it's true.
First of all, our bodies are temples. Well, my body's a temple.
Yeah.
The connections in your book are so fascinating and non-intuitive to tie the whole Trump movement into the Puritans and the monomyth. I mean, Trump actually says explicitly, I'm the only one who can solve your problems, right?
I alone can fix it. I am your redeemer. I am your punisher. These are, I mean, I'm not getting those last quotes exactly right, but these are all basically ideas that he trots out.
I find it like fascinating. Like for someone to blatantly take credit for everything that's good and to blatantly say anything's bad isn't their fault. It's just not a characteristic we like in anyone.
Yeah, I don't see how you could have those characteristics and not be a showbiz manager.
It's always baffling me. It's how unsophisticated it is. It just seems like it's a crazy pill thing. But I still think it's because there's a larger movement happening underneath it, and he just happens to be the best kind of spear to push it forward. But
when people are desperate, they grasp at straws.
Yeah.
And just because this is the second time you've said the word showbiz, I want to just point out tangentially that cult leaders are almost always either pursuing showbiz or have some history in it. Very common.
Chuck Manson was on a Beach Boys record.
Yep.
He had a record out.
Trump was on a reality show.
Yeah. L. Ron Hubbard, he was a screenwriter, right? Or book writer?
I think so, yeah. But certainly book writer.
And Jesus Christ, a tap dancer. which at the time, in sandals and on sand, was really difficult. Some say that's the ways that he went to walk on water, maybe looking for a better sound out of his tap shoes.
That was his first miracle.
I'm curious.
We call him Soggy Foot. Go ahead.
Old Soggy Foot. Please don't call him that. He's our Lord and Savior. we talked briefly right before we got on air that like you were getting some hate mail and stuff. I'm not baffled by that idea. I'm just curious specifically what kind of negative feedback you're getting from this book.
Matt, did you just kind of say that you hated her?
No. Wait, is that what subtext is?
Well, you kind of said you're getting a lot of hate mail. I'm not baffled by that.
You know, I did get one letter from this guy named Dat Monoli.
Oh, no. I thought I was being so clever, and you saw right through it. I thought the umlaut would help it.
Moonily.
No, I mean,
Moonily.
You're kind of taking on a lot of religious ideas and letting many people religious. So, like, that to me is why I said I'm sure you're getting some negative feedback, but I was wondering what specific ideas from your book you're getting the most kind of pushback on.
Well, so two answers. First of all, just to share, the most spectacular piece of hate mail I got was a guy, and a lot of the basic, he started out with some of the standards, you know, I'm a cunt, he wishes rape and death upon me, et cetera, et cetera. But then he said that the pilgrims are coming after me.
Them.
Yeah, that the pilgrims are going to be the ones, I guess, who rape and murder me.
They're a bike gang now, so maybe that's possible. I don't know.
Yes, he must have been writing about the bike gang. Yes, that makes sense now. That makes sense. And then immediately
they're trying
after
to get buckles on their helmets.
Right. It's the first Danksgiving. But then immediately after sending me this email, he sends a follow-up email that's like, actually, you know, you should tell my story. Maybe you're a cunt or maybe you're a real journalist. Let's talk.
Oh my gosh. Worst pigtail tug ever.
Yeah, that's right. He was negging me. He was a pua.
Lead with the neg and come in strong. Yeah. Yeah,
that's right. So we're dating now.
I ride in the back of his motorcycle.
His weed is dank. I'm getting some pushback, some discomfort about an idea I explore at the end of the book, which I would usually try to avoid talking about, but I would love your thoughts on it. Especially you guys. But so it's a bit of a preamble, but at the end of the book, I get into evolutionary biology. Why are we inclined toward us versus them thinking? And essentially, we evolved to cooperate as that's how we shot to the top of the food chain. It's not our brain size, it's our ability to cooperate. And the reason we had to learn to cooperate was because we were constantly being attacked by neighbors trying to take our resources, and we were constantly attacking our neighbors trying to take their resources. And so whoever could cooperate the best passed on their genes. And so one of the physiological, what's happening behind that in one case is oxytocin. So most people think of oxytocin as the cuddle hormone. It surges when women are breastfeeding, for example, when you're hugging someone, et cetera, your body gets flooded with oxytocin. And in those moments, what happens is that oxytocin is blunting the connection between the amygdala, our monkey brain, right, the oldest part of our brain, and something called the theory of mind network. The theory of mind network is, short story, what allows you to empathize with other people. So oxytocin blunts the amygdala, the fight or flight response, and allows you to like empathize and commune with others, et cetera. But oxytocin can also work in the other direction. It can blunt the theory of mind network and heighten the amygdala response. And so oxytocin also floods our systems whenever we feel like an outgroup is attacking us, or whenever we feel othered or are othering other people. And so at the end of the book, when I start exploring all of these bridges that I want us to create in order to mitigate division, because as I said, division fuels cult-like thinking, I, as a little bit of a thought experiment, wonder in print if there's no such thing as evil, if there's no distinction between good and evil. You know, I thought I was like pretty enlightened to believe that no one was pure evil or pure good, that we all had a little bit of both, right? I thought that was pretty enlightened. But now I'm wondering, maybe there is no difference, because oxytocin is oxytocin. It just works in different ways depending on the context. So maybe it's the context, and there's not even really such a thing as evil. So this is a long way of saying that people do not like that idea.
Jane, you are absolutely right that you came to the right place. You do not listen to this podcast, but if you've ever gift-wrapped something for Penn Jillette,
yeah.
It is, boy, does Penn love talking about the idea that there's no such thing as evil.
Well, I
and you much, just gave him a scientific approach to it.
Much of my life has been spent arguing against evil. As a matter of fact, Lawrence O'Donnell of MSNBC fame, when he and I are not talking about sex, which is most of the time, we talk about how he believes in evil and I don't. I don't want to ignore Jane's point to make the same point I've made a million times. I don't want to, but I'm going to. my problem is that if there is such a thing as evil, it kind of takes away responsibility in a certain way. If there's something else that exists that's evil, I think that wrong is a much better word than evil. You've brought in that feeling there, but you've also brought in something that I have a good friend of mine who is works in genetics and evolution and biology and so on. And she makes the point all the time that much of sociology, or maybe all of sociology and much of anthropology, are just so stories that are simply made up. So the idea of how evolution works is oversimplified and probably incorrect, you know, because you're not just selecting for what works best, but there's also a huge amount of luck, and there's also a huge amount of physiology, what happens to be on the gene with something else. Mm-hmm. So things can be selected for that are not in any way advantageous. I just wanted to say that, because I think it's important, because we kind of think that if we read On the Origin of Species, we can then kind of do a teleological explanation of everything. You know, we got here because it helped this, you know. And, but.
Which doesn't account for the role of epigenetics.
Right. It's an epigeneticist that is just slapping me around so I don't say stuff like that. the Just So stories. I think that us and them and good and evil are the exact same idea.
Mm-hmm.
And also the fact that there even is an us. I mean, everybody's changing so often, there isn't even really a sense, any sort of real sense in which there's a self, let alone a good or bad self, and let alone those selves can join together. I try very hard to not fall into tribalism and, you know, to quote Dylan, fearing not I become my enemy in the instant that I preached. As soon as you start talking about people who see everybody as us and them, you, in that instant, you've done an us and them.
Mm-hmm. We've othered Trump quite a bit in the last hour.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I tried really hard to always use us and not use them. And even the language conspires against you. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to form a sentence talking about something you disagree with without making it somebody you disagree with.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm already feeling that oxytocin argument helping me process what you're saying right now, though. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I never thought of it on that level. But like, you know, as we try to clarify what we're thinking about, like even we break through one barrier, you're like, oh, good. Like I've figured something out, like by excluding those idiots. You know, like it's really interesting. This is gonna be a tough one.
So you do you have any sort of watch me bring it all back together? Any sort of checklist for how you try to process information that comes into you so that you aren't sucked into that thinking?
Well, first of all, I will say I very much am sucked into that thinking. I fall prey to it all the time, as I think we almost all do. And it's very, people have a knee-jerk response to cults, which is that wouldn't happen to me. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, based on research, it can happen to anyone because it's not the person, it's the context. It's what's going on in their life, what's making them feel vulnerable or without or isolated without community or, you know, financially desperate. What's making them desperate, right? And so we all fall prey to this cult-like thinking in the macro as well. And it's very challenging to peruse social media when everything that's being sent to me is specifically designed to hook me. It's very challenging not to fall for it. I struggle with it every day. I should have a checklist. I mean, I rely on my critical thinking skills, of course, and I always look for a source, and maybe that's my training as a journalist. But I think maybe another thing to do is to check my emotional response, to pause and say, what am I feeling emotionally right now? And is that by design? Am I supposed, did someone want me to have that emotional response? Because the problem is not necessarily the ideas, although I do think some of the ideology I explore is problematic. But for the most part, the problem is when we're manipulated by it. The problem is the exploitation. The problem is the greed and the cruelty beyond that. Although even the word cruelty makes me, I'm reluctant to say, but anyway, go ahead.
Have you followed this story of the, unethical study that was done on Reddit with the, I'm going to use a term that doesn't mean anything, AI, but let's just say bots, the bots going on Reddit. There's a subreddit of Change My View, Change My Mind. It's a rather well-known one that I'd heard about, but I wasn't really familiar with. But it's a place that you go where people try to change each other's minds on ideas.
Sounds interesting.
And, you know, you have, like, to give your gross examples, you have, like, a black man coming out against Black Lives Matter and making that point and so on. Well, these researchers, if you want to call them that, used a bot that was optimized to go for how much they could change minds. And they put them on without identifying them as bots, but they were on as real people. The black man arguing against Black Lives Matter was a bot, which for, in terms of sloppy speaking, let's just say AI. And the punchline, I mean, there's a lot of talk. There's a podcast called Hard Fork that talks about tech issues. They pointed out that there's a lot of talk about this research being unethical and immoral, and that the paper won't be published for that reason. But they said, and it's a rather strong point, that the conclusion of that article is actually more interesting. The bots were much more successful than any people had been on that in changing minds.
Oof.
Why?
Because it was learning with just that point of view, just to change minds. So it was finding out the techniques. It was combing through all the stuff and finding out the techniques that worked on people.
Manipulation and exploitation.
Yeah. But if we are going to, well, not are going to, if we are right now, as we speak, having large language learning programs, learning to do this manipulation and learning to pull people into cults, I think what I'm basically saying is give up. Let go and let God is what I'm saying, Jane.
Yeah,
if you want to make God laugh, make plans. But the fact that we've now gotten to the point that there will be programs which will be more persuasive than people, and that they will be trying to do the manipulation, the exploitation, this whole problem should be taken to another level.
I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is the distinction between the bots trying to convince people on this thread and actual people trying to convince others is that the bots don't have empathy. Like, you only try to persuade someone for so long if you have empathy.
Right.
And you mentioned earlier that you're trying to start a cult. And I would say you will never be successful at that because you have empathy. That's the only distinction in my mind between a cult leader and everyone else. You could Google right now, how do I start a cult, and figure it out, you know, in 5 minutes. But you would fail at it because you have empathy.
Well, that was the thought experiment I would always run around around Trump. And if I told you right now you could have everything you wanted in your life, every material thing, but also all the love and acceptance you could possibly want, and all you had to do was never, ever admit you were wrong, I don't think you could do it. I think that's too big a cost. And yet there are a very, very small number of people who are able to do that. And I believe that that's a superpower. And I think that's another way of stating not having empathy is an incredibly powerful thing.
But can you actually have love if you're not, if you never say you're wrong? Can you actually have a relationship that would be characterized as loving?
Not by me, no.
Yeah.
But you might be able to get something that felt like that, you know. I think it was Randy Newman that wrote, money may not buy you love in this world, but it'll get you a half pound of cocaine and a 16-year-old girl in a long black limousine on a hot September night. That may not be love, but it's all right.
Wow. And he chose the number 16.
Yes, he chose the number 16. But, you know, once again, Randy Newman.
Why not say 18? I mean, we're talking about a 2 years difference. Like, he's really drawing a line in the sand. He's digging in.
I believe it's the S sound. I believe it's a reference to Chuck Berry. And I also believe that Randy Newman is writing from the point of view of someone who he doesn't agree with, as he's written from the point of view of Hitler and the point of view of racists so on. But I think if you're going to address the idea of rock and roll exploiting children, you have to go back to Chuck Berry, and you're going to go with 16. If you want to go to the Beatles, you want to go to 17.
I didn't realize this was historical research, informed satire. Now it makes sense.
Yeah. But it is satire. It is informed. And I just think that if you're going to do that rock and roll shock, you're going to want to come back to she's 16, she's beautiful, and she's mine, and sweet little 16, which
it's
are
fun for a night.
Well, you know, I have always believed the three most overrated things in the world: pickup trucks, banjo music, and teenage girls.
I'm with you on everything but banjo. I love the sound of a banjo. People hate it, though. You're in the majority. People hate the banjo.
Well, you know, some people say perfect pitch is the ability to recognize the sound of a banjo being thrown in a dumpster next to an accordion. But, but you know, as someone who studied America so much, of course you have to love the banjo because it's one of the few real American instruments, even though it does come, it has its antecedents in Africa, of course. Mm-hmm. It really is, especially that five-string motherfucker is an American. You know, musical comedy, stand-up comedy, and banjos may be all America's given to the world.
And those are all, you know, plebeian art forms, so to speak.
Yeah, you're
those
right.
Are all lowbrow, you know, art forms for the masses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is part of that anti-intellectual, anti-elite, rebel aesthetic.
Yeah, boy, you know, I sure wish I didn't feel that rebel thing so strongly, you know? It's so hard to fight. It just seems tramps like us, maybe we're born to run. Mm-hmm. You know, it just seems the romanticism of that. Yeah.
But you know, it's not a
Clint Eastwood.
Well, Clem, you lost me there. You lost me at Clint Eastwood. But I think world.
Wait, let me say one thing.
Okay.
Cunt. Are you going to trash Clint Eastwood?
Conversation for another day, but the world needs rebels. The world needs
lucky
iconoclasts. Yeah, no, I'm not feeling lucky. No, I think
perfectly.
The fact that you're thoughtful about it makes it less problematic. It's not problematic to be a rebel. It's problematic to be an uninvestigated rebel, because then you're not aware of what's triggering your rebelliousness. Then it's knee jerk. And you don't strike me as that.
It's also the rebellion that's not really rebellion. I mean, if you are siding with the President of the United States of America, you are in no way, shape, or form a rebel. Mm-hmm. There's no definition of rebel that includes I'm supporting the President of the United States of America, you know. Mm-hmm. Somebody, and I don't know how this ties in exactly, but it seems so important to me, is that Trump is a poor person's view of what a billionaire would be. In terms of, if I had that much money, I would use that money to punish all the people who made fun of me. I would use that money. Things that, as a rule, billionaires don't do. That retribution thing, it's certainly not something we see. Well, I guess it's something we see in Peter Thiel to the max.
Right.
But it's not something you see in Bill Gates. When Bill Gates' nemesis is malaria, we feel much better about that, you know, as opposed to the people that, you know, didn't, made the wrong kind of joke at a dinner. It's a very, very good book. And and the ideas are wicked important. And also, although I guess it doesn't matter to many other people, the exact level of wit in it. You always have your wit in service of the idea, and you never bend the idea to go to a joke. Mm-hmm. And that is very, very difficult, especially someone with the amount of improv experience you have. Matt Donnelly has never been able to finish a thought without bending it for the joke. Is that right, Matt?
Sure, that's absolutely true.
But you
incredible
know.
Improviser Matt Donnelly, I will say, since it came up.
Sure.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you draw the distinction between, you didn't get to this probably, Matt, but she draws the distinction between being obsessed with improv comedy and being in a cult. Why improv comedy isn't a cult?
Yeah, it's page four of the book. And everyone who knows that I have that in my background asks, like, well, did you think UCB was a cult? And I'm like, page four of the book.
Yeah.
And I eventually come down on the side of arguing that it wasn't, because I don't think anyone was being exploited. We were performing for free, but the theater had no money and we were all doing it voluntarily, and it didn't feel like exploitation to
me. It was more like a commune than
right. It was more like a commune, yeah.
We certainly would deify a few teachers, but we certainly didn't it was a very bad cult. If it was a cult, it was a very bad
Yeah. Yeah, they failed.
But you also do, in comedy, we do have Kenny, right? We do have jumping off the cliff in Hawaii.
Mm. Yes.
Kenny, what's his name?
How can I blanket his name?
Douglas Kenny. I said Kenny, though. I didn't say Kenny. Doug Kenny, yeah.
I thought you were talking about Father Yode.
No.
Who's that's Father the Source Yode? Family. That's the hang glider.
Oh, Father Yode. Well, that's right. But also Doug Kenny. They both go off a cliff.
Oh.
Father Yode, I'm aspiring to be.
Right.
His tale to me is aspirational. I mean, Moon Zappa worked at his restaurant.
It's an exciting story. And he's a fascinating figure because he does seem to have believed his own con, or come to believe his own con, which always interests me the most in these kind of figures.
It always started late. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you want to address that, we could, because I'm fascinated by it, and I'd love to hear your thoughts. What do you think about the difference between a cult leader who is eyes open and eyes shut?
I think it comes in every variety of the math equation. There are some who start out as cons and con artists and always remain so. There are some who start out as con artists and then drink their own flavor aid, so to speak. There are some who start out as true believers and then become con, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I find it most fascinating when they start out as con artists and then fall for their own con. Because often what happens in those cases is you see them questioning it. You see their cognitive dissonance. And in the last chapter of the book, I explore the group Love Has Won, which was Amy Carlson, the mother god. She was, mm-hmm. This was just recently. She was found, her body was purple from having ingested colloidal silver. I interviewed Andrew Profaci, one of her father gods along the way. And he said that he used to have these late night conversations with her where he was able to convince her that she wasn't God. And she would say, yeah, no, you're right. You're right. You're right. And then the next day she'd get sucked back into it again. And that's the most interesting to me. I think maybe because it humanizes these people to see them kind of grappling with that. But Father Yode certainly did as well. And arguably, he ultimately did believe. That's why he thought he could survive a hang gliding attempt, having never been on one of those machines before.
Yeah. Charlie Manson, I think, starts out as a complete con and may very well stay a complete con the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Jonestown, that was a con the whole time.
Oh, it was.
Yeah. Yeah. He, you know, in the early years, he did a lot of good and his church was somewhat mainstream in the beginning. But he always had ulterior motives.
And David Koresh?
I don't know. I think
L. Ron Hubbard.
That seems to have been a con all along. But I think David Koresh believed that he was the Messiah. At what point did he believe that? And did he always believe that? I don't know. You know, these people are driven by power. Power, in my opinion, is a parasite. Once you get a little bit of it, it takes over. And there's nothing you can do to stop it from following its path, which is to accrue more and more of itself. The ultimate, the terminus of that path is control over life and death, which is what gods do. And that's what happened at Jonestown. Power consumes, and ultimately it consumes life, other people. And so when someone has been overtaken by the power parasite, it's hard to discern what they do and don't believe or what any of their other motives may have ever been.
Mm. Also, when, you know, I have to say this, I mentioned Dylan, we talked about evil. So I have to say this one other thing I say every day, and that is, it's also the end justifies the means.
Right.
Which is an idea to me that once you decide the end justifies the means on anything, there seems to be no way back.
Right. Everything is justified. Do whatever you want.
Right. Because there is no end. There are only means.
There are only means.
There's no such thing as a narrative. It doesn't exist in the real world. We impose it on that. Once we impose an end on it, then any means is okay.
That's doomsday thinking. The idea that you can impose a narrative on life, on the history of our globe, as if maybe history isn't even a thing. But I describe it as life and time used to be a circle, and suddenly it's a line.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which is not true.
Part of the problem is the written word on that, you know, too. Because pre-written word, you told your stories based on what stories were useful to your group of people at that time. And then you start being able to write, and you start laying it out, and you stop writing at some point, and you stop it from being a circle. That gives you a story. But it's a great book. It's a great, great book.
Thanks, and, Penn.
People, is it doing well?
You know, I haven't asked. I don't want to know. I think we're building momentum. You know, I'm getting incredible response from readers, and that's the most important thing to me, people reaching out to say how much it resonates.
Well, don't you want power?
Yes, I do. I really want money. I'm so tired of being broke. I mean, if the billionaires, if you won't get taxed, could you just give me some? God.
If that is your problem with your ambition and how focused you are, I have some products that you could use. I mean, you know, just helping your friends. You wouldn't be exploiting them. You'd be helping them with a really good product.
Sounds
so
great.
We can help you out of this.
I love losing my friends. thanks for having me. I think my biggest goal with this book is to try to, like I said, acknowledgement and recognition. I want to point out, to use a metaphor from your word, I'm trying to point out the magic trick. I'm trying to say how they do it so that we stop falling for it. So thanks for helping me spread the word.
Cults Like Us by Jane Borden. So thank you so much for taking much more time.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
But for right now, that was Penn Sunday School, brought to you by masterclass.com/Penn. That was Penn Sunday School. Anybody else you want to thank there, Matt Donnelly?
I want to thank the five people who support us over at patreon.com/Penn. Michelle Yizer, Brogan Hastings, Placida Scott, Damian Martin, Garth Reynolds, Adam Luce, Timo Tehoff, Mark Pickenheim, Adam Berzins, Carlos Alvarez, Michael Cornwall, Rob Aligar, Ross Devereaux, Ryan Matthews, Jeff Bakker, Michael Torbay. That's it, just Michael Torbay. Ilan Lee, Jeff Loomis, Jacob McCauley, Nicole Martin, Sugar Rush Socio, Music Man, Keith Corning, No Thank You Daddy, Rachel Hawkins, Josh Smith, Richard, Peter Hoke and Sally Stewart, Kelly McCauley, Robin Garnett, Tom and JL are listening to Frank Sinatra, Ovi Demetrian Jr., Jeremy R22, Winter Ryakowski, Vern Wood, Kristen Kladick, Fifi, Hattie Wabi, Michael Cohen, Jeremiah Jenkins. Sometimes I wonder if Matt gets annoyed at the really long Patreon names that people write down that he has to read at the... Alexander Hoffman, Danny Olwine, Stephen Volcano, Jim the Game Magician who learned a lot about aftermarket breasts, Scooped Mids, and Paul McBride. Thank you so much.
Thank you!